There's nothing the country cured with a wink and a fart, and you're listening to WGXC in Accra, 90.7 FM.
You can find out about so many local events, like the traditional Irish music session. Every Sunday, there's an open Irish music jam at the Shamrock House in East Durham from 2 to 5 p.m. Find out more on the WGXC community calendar online at WGXC.org and add your own event to the WGXC community calendar and have it read on the radio at 90.7 FM by going to WGXC.org and clicking on the community calendar.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Upstate Films, featuring first-run and repertory films at movie theaters located in Rhinebeck and Saugerties, as well as live music, filmmaker conversations, staged readings, community events, variety shows, magic, comedy, and more. The Hudson Valley Picture Show traveling series brings cinema to locations around the region. The latest schedules, as well as upcoming pop-up events at the Community Theater in Catskill, can be found at upstatefilms.org.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Richard Goldstein of Lafayette Hill, Pennsylvania. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to WGXC.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. Andrea Mirko reports for Porcupine Soup that the Hudson Athens Lighthouse Preservation Society is getting $500,000 from the state to help restore the Hudson Athens Lighthouse. In announcing the grant, Governor Kathy Hochul's office said, and I quote, "The Hudson Athens Preservation Society will repair and restore the underwater foundation of the Hudson Athens Lighthouse. The Phase 2 project will involve interior foundation floor core, foundation design, interior basement asbestos and coal removal, and electrical system upgrade. This phase will allow the critical big work on the underwater foundation to begin shortly," end quote. The nonprofit Hudson Athens Lighthouse Preservation Society announced in May that engineers were warning that the lighthouse could collapse into the Hudson River within 5 years if the foundation was not repaired. The grant is a part of the Regional Economic Development Council initiative. The Hudson Athens Lighthouse has been guiding river traffic since November 14, 1874. It was a manned lighthouse until the 1950s when it became automated. Read more about this story in Porcupine Soup. Liz Montgomery reports for Porcupine Soup that the Old Factory Brewing Company in Cairo is getting a matching $34,500 grant from New York State to purchase new equipment. It is one of 108 projects awarded grants through New York's Craft Beverage Micro Grant Program. Old Factory Brewing Company plans to add a grain silo, grain auger, and walk-in cooler to make more beer. This is another Regional Economic Development Council initiative project grant. Lieutenant Governor Antonio Delgado, formerly the area's congressional representative, said, and I quote, "The Regional Economic Development Councils continue to help strategic investments to historical distressed communities throughout New York State," end quote. Read more about this story in Porcupine Soup. Mid-Hudson News reports that a few days after an election ended and at the farthest point from facing voters again, the Dutchess County Legislature Budget, Finance, and Personnel Committee proved a substantial increase in salaries for most elected officials there. County legislators would get a 68% increase under the proposal. The county executive salary would go from $157,424 to $185,500, and the county clerk will see an increase from $119,330 to $150,000 in 2024. The Dutchess County Comptroller and Sheriff would not get pay increases until 2026 under the proposal. Legislator Michael Polasek said that the proposed pay hikes are, and I quote, almost identical to the United States Bureau of Labor Statistics CPI inflation rate for that time. For those reasons, we believe it was fair and equitable to the hardworking elected officials in their next term, and I am pleased it garnered bipartisan support, end quote. Only one Democrat voted for the measure. For, and I quote, bipartisan, end quote, is a bit of an exaggeration in this case. Read more about this story at Mid-Hudson News. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. You can visit our website at WGXC.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXC sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Friday, November 17th. Local early morning temperatures range from 29 degrees in Steventown to 46 in Skodak. Regional average soil temperature is 44. Wrap up if you head outside today. It will be windy. We get a high of 62 degrees at 1 p.m., and the increasing cloud cover will usher in rain an hour or so after dark. Rain will be strongest between 9 p.m. and 3 a.m. We will see a low of 45 degrees. Tomorrow, the rain should vacate the area by 10 a.m., and we see the winds will stick around, and we get a high of 49 degrees. Overnight, temperatures dip to 32 degrees, then Sunday will be dry and breezy with a high of 42. Sunset today will be at 4:20 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 6:44 a.m. Looking way up, we see the Leonid meteor shower is underway and due to peak tonight into tomorrow. Unfortunately, the approaching front does not bode well for sky watchers, but tomorrow night, things could be improved. Plasma winds will be slow at 341 kilometers per second with a thin density of 1 proton per cubic centimeter. Radio propagation conditions are currently fair below 8 megahertz till dark, then fair below 60 megahertz with good conditions below 4 megahertz overnight. There are no chances for aurora this evening. And this has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
2 weeks, 14 days, 326 hours. Every second that your family could be exposed to radiation after a nuclear attack. Radiation that kills.
To survive, a fallout shelter is a necessity. Equipment and supplies are essential.
Now, Survive All Shelters, one of the nation's leading manufacturers of fallout shelters, offers a basic equipment kit with
a Conelrad high-powered radio, transistor-operated for long battery life.
A complete, fully stocked first aid kit.
A heavy-duty fire extinguisher, emergency water containers, a chemical toilet for protection against contamination and disease.
Extra-strength Saran and Rayon bunks.
A radiation meter and individual dosimeters.
For protection every second of each hour of every day. See a survival shelter now.
I don't know how you guys feel about the shape of the world these days, but you know this guy, Donald Trump? You heard this? People talk about him a lot, and because people are talking about him, we talk about him, like, say, the 91 charges he's facing, which is, technically speaking, and I don't want to get to the legal jargon here, that's a lot. That's a lot of charges. But it has, as much as all of us talk and think about this numbnut, every so often, it's really important with this guy, it's important to, let's say, metaphorically, jam the sharpened stick of knowledge into the soft inner thigh of your mind and just grind it around a little bit to try to reawaken the horror of what our country would be like if this hate-filled dingus and his soulless goons ever got a hold of power again. Because, and I I don't know if you've noticed, but Donald Trump is a fascist. Too harsh, you say? Fine. But consider this, my friends. Over the past week, Trump has repeatedly compared his political opponents to vermin who he will root out. First, okay, that's dehumanizing his fellow Americans. Second, if he's really looking for vermin, he should start with his own lawyer, who I believe is an alcoholic mole rat. Okay. Now, further, my friends, if the word vermin has a hint of Himmler to you, well spotted, because according to the Washington Post, Trump has long toyed with the language of fascists, but is now echoing dictators like Hitler and Mussolini. Yes, some in the media are starting to suspect that the guy who sent a violent mob to murder his vice president so he could stay in power might have a dark side. Yesterday, Trump's campaign pushed back on this comparison to jackbooted dictators with this reassuring statement. Those who try to make that ridiculous assertion are clearly snowflakes grasping for anything, and their entire existence will be crushed when President Trump returns to the White House. Furthermore, anyone who says I'm a cannibal is a liar, and if they say it again, I will eat their delicious face. You'd look pretty good on a bun, buddy. Now, naturally, this spokesman's initial statement there was perceived as a bit extreme. So the spokesman, and this is real, later clarified that instead of crushing their entire existence, he meant to say their sad, miserable existence. So less of a walk it back and more of a goose step it forward. Here's another thing that fascists enjoy doing. They cling to power after the voters reject them. That's what Trump is on trial for in Georgia, where prosecutors have gotten multiple Trump associates to plead guilty, including former Trump attorney and school parent explaining why the very hungry caterpillar is homosexual agenda. Jenna Ellis. Last night, video leaked of Ellis revealing to prosecutors that in the December of 2020, a Trump White House aide told her that even though the lawyers were telling Trump that he definitely lost, quote, the boss is not going to leave. Thanks to Jonathan Carl's new book, we're also learning more about Trump's belief in some of the weirder QAnon theories that have percolated out there. For instance, back in 2021, the Q folks were all saying that Trump would be reinstated on August 13th, 2021, as part of the so-called storm, when Trump would expose the cabal of Satan-worshipping pedophile elites and declare martial law, meaning he would remain in power and conduct mass arrests and executions of top Democrats or other supposed members of the cabal. Oh, 2021. It was a crazy time. Of course, since then, most of the more insane believers in that nonsense have been sentenced to Congress. But it turns out it wasn't just your aunt on Facebook who bought into Q, because that summer Trump was telling people that he expected he would get reinstated by August. Come on. Cult leaders should never get high on their own supply. My MAGA faithful, put on your Nikes and watch me drink all this delicious Kool-Aid. It's all mine. Yum, 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 yum. I'm the Kool-Aid man. Oh, yeah. I can't feel my fingers. Why am I so sleepy? Why am I? And now Jonathan Carl has released audio from the summer of 2021 showing just how deeply Trump believed this nonsense.
You don't really think there's a way you would get reinstated before the next election, do you?
I'm not going to explain it to you, Jonathan, because you wouldn't either understand it or write it.
I'm not going to explain it to you, Jonathan, you know. I know how it would work, Jonathan, but you wouldn't understand. How about you tell me how you would get me reinstated to stop the Satan cabal, Frito Banditos, or whatever the chock full of nutsos are yammering to me about? What's your idea, John?
Now let's talk about Trump's new immigration plan. It's just like the old one, but with more worser. And no surprise, this plan has the same old author, Trump advisor Stephen Miller. Miller's new plan includes some of Trump's greatest hits like sweeping raids and mass deportations, alongside fresh horrors, rounding up undocumented people and detaining them in giant camps. To make the giant internment camps sound a little more family-friendly, Miller assured reporters that the camps would look professional. Professional? Fuh-shoo! It may be a giant step down the road to totalitarianism, but on the bright side, no Crocs. Now, this is all made a lot Hitlerier by the fact that Trump's former chief of staff, John Kelly, claims Trump once told him Hitler did a lot of good things. Okay, I think we have enough data points. Have we proven that Trump is a fascist? To find out, let's bring out the Donald Trump dictatometer. Here we go. Trump calls his opponents vermin, says he will crush those who disagree with him, holds on to power at all costs, would declare martial law to stop an imaginary evil cabal, plans to put people in camps, and says Hitler had some good ideas. Jim? He's gone, and he's never coming back, because our joke solved everything.
Donald Trump.
In honor of our great veterans on Veterans Day, we pledge to you that we will root out the communists, Marxists, fascists, and the radical left thugs that live like vermin within the confines of our country.
Be Heil! Heil! Right.
Donald Trump.
Space not to love.
Donald Trump.
He's a great disgrace, so be Heil!
Donald Trump.
Space.
Donald Trump
says
the threat from outside forces is far less sinister, dangerous, and grave than the threat from within.
Be Heil! Heil! Right.
Donald Trump.
Space.
Donald Trump
says
It could certainly happen in reverse. They've done something that nobody thought would happen. They've done indictments in order to win an election. It could certainly happen in reverse. What they've done is they've released the genie out of the box. You understand that?
Be Heil! Heil!
Donald Trump.
Space. Are we not the Superman? Are you pure Superman?
Yeah, we are the Superman.
Super duper Superman.
Is this Nazi land so good? Would you leave it if you could?
Yeah, this Nazi land is good. We would leave it if we could.
We bring the world new order.
Donald Trump.
This world new order. Everyone a foreign race. We love
Donald Trump.
Space when we bring to the world disorder. When
Donald Trump
says
our threat is from within.
Be Heil! Heil! Right in
Donald Trump.
Space not to love.
Donald Trump.
He's a great disgrace, so be Heil! Heil! Right in
Donald Trump.
Space.
We pledge to you that we will root out the communists, Marxists, fascists, and the radical left thugs that live like vermin within the confines of our country.
Be Heil! Heil! Right.
Donald Trump.
Space not to love.
Donald Trump.
He's a great disgrace, so be Heil! Heil! Right in.
Donald Trump.
Space!
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Instead of being met with leaders engaging with us, we were met by police pulling people to the ground in riot gear, macing people.
Activist Danny Noble attacks the response to the more than 100 pro-Palestinian demonstrators demanding an Israeli ceasefire outside the Democratic National Committee headquarters in Washington, D.C. Some members of Congress attending a reception inside were evacuated in police vehicles. Demonstrators also managed to shut down bridges in Boston and San Francisco, where President Joe Biden and world leaders were gathering for an economic summit. The Senate has passed a stopgap spending bill to avoid a government shutdown with a little time to spare. Majority Leader Chuck Schumer hailed new House Speaker Mike Johnson for working with Democrats.
Because of bipartisan cooperation, we're keeping the government open without any poison pills or harmful cuts to vital programs.
The bill keeps all government agencies open until January 19th and some a bit longer. But members of the House Freedom Caucus, including Texas Congressman Chip Roy, say Johnson's failure to win concessions leaves them with little to campaign on.
I would have shoved down the throats of the United States Senate a funding bill that included Israel and dared Chuck Schumer to shut the government down and go home and eat turkey.
Republican senators tried and failed for the second time in 2 weeks to undo Alabama Senator Tommy Tuberville's hold on more than 400 military nominees. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina supports Tuberville's position on abortion, but says the hold is eroding national security.
The policy is wrong, but holding these officers who had nothing to do with this is wrong.
The GOP senators say they are prepared to vote for a Democratic resolution to change Senate rules if Tuberville refuses to budge. Republican New York Representative George Santos says he won't seek re-election. A just-released House Ethics Committee report describes substantial evidence that Santos broke federal laws, but he's refusing to resign.
I will continue to fight to defend myself. I will continue to serve the 3rd Congressional District of New York until the people choose to not have me.
Politico reports Nevada Attorney General Aaron Ford is investigating Republican operatives who falsely pledged the state's 6 electoral votes to former President Donald Trump in 2020, despite him losing the state. Ford says the matter has been on his radar for some time.
I don't make prosecutorial decisions based on partisan or political preferences. Never have.
False electors in Georgia and Michigan are already facing criminal charges. Arizona is investigating that state's alternative Trump slate. A Michigan judge says Trump can remain on the state's 2024 primary ballot following a legal attempt to remove him due to his role in the January 6th insurrection. A similar lawsuit was just dismissed by the Minnesota State Supreme Court, and a decision in Colorado is expected next week. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Voters in 3 Michigan cities approved ranked choice voting November 7th, but state law doesn't yet allow it. November 15th, the Voter Choice Act was reintroduced in the U.S. Senate, proposing matching funds for state and local governments to implement RCV. Voters in Kalamazoo, Royal Oak, and East Lansing passed changes to their city charters to allow ranked choice voting for mayor and city commission. That's good news for democracy advocates who argue that RCV offers more options for voters, guarantees a majority winner, and costs less in the long run by eliminating expensive and low turnout runoff elections. Problem is, Michigan law doesn't allow RCV, though Michigan Live reports that a state representative plans to introduce a bill to allow it. Meanwhile, in Washington, U.S. Senators Michael Bennett of Colorado and Angus King of Maine reintroduced the Voter Choice Act, proposing $40 million in federal matching funds to help states and municipalities implement ranked choice voting systems. Maine and Alaska currently use it statewide. Nevada and Arizona will vote on it in 2024, and 50 counties and cities have adopted it, making it one of the fastest-growing democracy reforms. Passage of the Voter Choice Act is unlikely in the U.S. House because the Republican National Committee recently opposed RCV. We have more on ranked choice voting and the groups taking action at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Welcome back with your host, Randall Martin. And, you know, today we're talking about the theme of communication. And I have a very special guest, a wonderful person here in the Hudson Valley, many of which you know, and maybe that some that you don't know. But after this interview, you will know all about her. And we're going to be speaking to Rabbi Zoe Bizak. Zoe, how are you?
I'm well, thank you, Randall. It's wonderful to be here. How are you doing?
You know, I am sort of in between a lot of different thoughts, I think, as many people. I've got a lot of things kind of buzzing around in my head. You know, the holidays, the world, you know, it's just a lot of things happening. And I know that you, as I was explaining now, our pre-telephone conversations, our pre-interview conversations, that I know you as Rabbi Rabbi Zoe. However, there are many facets. You're a singer. You're a pianist. You're an author. You're an accordionist, writer and accordionist at the Peace Ensemble. How do you make time and balance all of those pursuits as well as being a rabbi?
Well, I feel like a professional juggler is the truth of it. And that is really how I feel most of the time. I guess I have a lot of passions for a lot of things, and I was a musician first, and so my music has always carried me through my life, and my prayer life and my music life weave together, excuse me, very harmoniously, and everything comes from those two things.
You know, I've heard you sing. I love the way you sing. And seeing you perform, and actually I was just listening to, you got a performance on your Facebook page with you and a bass player, and I'm sitting here as a drummer, I'm thinking, you know what, I could put a reggae beat to the back of what you were doing, and it would fit just perfectly in this, what song is that? The first song in the concert.
I don't know which song because there's a lot of videos on my Facebook page, so I don't know which one, but my bass player, Robert Bard, he joins me. He's also in the Peace Ensemble.
Okay.
And with me, and he plays at my synagogue, Temple Israel of Catskill, for many of our services. And I call Robert my musical brother because he is, and what a joy he is to play with. And anytime you want to come and bring your drums and add them, that would be a great blessing.
You got, you know, you got a deal. I was sitting there listening, and I was thinking about, you know, some jazzy beats and other things. And then I just, you know, I was in my mind, I was accompanying with it, shifted to a reggae beat, and coming in the three, and it fit perfectly with what you were singing. I'm like, wow, that would be amazingly interesting.
Well, let's do it sometime. Okay. I love it.
Okay,
great.
Well, we're talking about communications today, and how, I think especially the holidays are complicated enough with trying to communicate with relatives and people in a stressful environment of the holidays, people traveling a long time to get there and all the other, and you know, they have maybe different dietary things. And then all the other sort of generalized anxiety from politics to what's happening in the world, I think it's become a much more polarized time to have any sort of conversation, but yet that's the basis of how we live. From a spiritual perspective, how can people go about having productive conversations that don't end in fists?
Yes. Yes. I'd say it's what you and I are doing right now. You're speaking, I'm listening. I'm speaking, you're listening. It's not always an easy thing to do. And we tend to spend time with people who are often like-minded.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe from the same place, maybe go to the same place of worship or work together. Or, you know, we tend to, but it's really important, and my life is so deeply enriched by being and spending time with and getting to know people from who live differently than I do, who were raised differently, who are from different places, of a different race, of a different ethnicity. It's so important because how else can we learn about how someone who's different from us lives? And what they experience and what their challenges are and how they view the world and what they eat and what their customs are and what their music is. And, you know, so especially right now with the world being turned upside down, it's never been more important to make sure that we don't just insulate ourselves out of fear, which is quite easy to do, and I think the natural reaction. But it's really a time to make sure we keep openness so that we can keep learning and keep expanding how we think and keep evolving to become more loving and more accepting and more supportive of others.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, it sounds simple, you know, listening,
but yes,
it is not necessarily simple at all. And, you know, I think that, as you say, I know that you travel a lot. You go from Albany to Woodstock. You have a pulse on the region. And I think that having conversations, like as you say, when you have conversations with people that you know that are like-minded, those are easy conversations because you're basically going to be agreeing, for the most part, on the major tenets of any issues, as and maybe with the exception of a sports team or something like that. But on the other issues, world issues, political issues, these can become thorny subjects. And I hearken back to what my parents used to tell me, is that, you know, you can disagree without being disagreeable.
Beautiful.
How do you? But when people now, you know, but that was a different time ago. That was many, many, many years ago, decades ago, I should say. How do you, when there are deeply felt opinions, when people are rooted in things that are passionate, that they believe, and how do you have a conversation where people are not necessarily listening and they're rooted in the belief and they don't necessarily come to the table with a desire to learn something new or to hear a different perspective or to show empathy? They just come because they have an opinion and they want to speak it.
Yeah. I would say that's such a hard and challenging situation. You know, if you have two people sitting down who care about one another and want to know how the other one really feels and what the other one's really going through and, you know, willing to listen, that's one thing. But if you sit down with someone who only wants to speak but not listen, it's really hard. I've had some very hard conversations lately, and some of them have turned out so beautifully, just where I've just been weeping with a connection and feeling someone else's pain who thinks differently than I do and has a different perspective. And I've also come to, I hate the expression, but butting heads, but, you know, I've come to also had some conversations where they don't seem to go, they're not productive. They don't seem to, they haven't yet harmonized. Mm-hmm. And I'm praying about that a lot to see how I can, you know, like in Judaism, we always say, you know, you have to turn it and turn it. You turn a situation around and look at it from every aspect. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you get a different viewpoint. You might be able to think of something differently. You might have a different question. And so with those relationships and those conversations that I've had that haven't had the outcome that I've want and hoping and praying for, I'm still turning those things around to try to see what else can I do? How can I approach this differently? Because I really want to have, I want to be compassionate towards everybody, and I want to have conversations that lead to peacefulness and working together and understanding each other better.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
All right. So with the recent influx of asylum seekers, there will be a celebration of the people and of asylum on Sunday, November 19th. And to tell us more about this event, we are now joined by Karen Beadle. Welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you so much.
So what is, can you give us a brief overview of what is taking place in the Capital Region right now regarding asylum?
Well, what's happening and has been happening since May is that we have an asylum-seeking population that is officially here, and they are sponsored by New York City. So these are asylum seekers who came through the southwestern border and relocated to New York City and went through the shelter system in New York City and are technically still in some ways part of the shelter system in New York City, but they're being housed in four different hotels here in the Capital Region.
What's your relationship with this issue?
Me personally?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, my name is Karen Beadle, and I'm part of Capital District Border Watch, which is an organization that was formed in 2019. It grew out of the organizing around families and children who were separated at the border under the Trump-era immigration policies. And so we have been doing advocacy and education about the right to asylum and to support asylum seekers both at the border and in our community.
Did you have a follow-up before?
Oh, I was wondering, have you noticed if many of these refugees are coming from the same areas down south, or is it a central location, like a central event?
Yes. So, you know, there are a lot of trends that you see in migration, right? And it largely has to do with political instability in various regions. Sometimes it's economic instability. You know, these days it can be more related to climate change. But people are here for very particular reasons that have to do with why their region is unstable. And two of the larger populations of folks who are in the hotels in the capital region are from Venezuela and Mauritania. The Mauritanians have come really far, traveled through Africa. Some of them then traveled up through Latin America, through Panama. Similarly, the Venezuelans also traveled mostly by land to be here. And it's simply because conditions are really untenable for living, for working, for raising families, for having basic security. And then we also see a lot of vulnerable populations, GLBTQ folks, who are particularly vulnerable. We have families in the capital region, Venezuelan families, also families from Latin America. Most of the families are Spanish-speaking, so they are Mexican, Venezuelan, and from Central America.
So when the event is to celebrate asylum, how will asylum be celebrated on Sunday?
Well, you know, it's very important for us to educate the community about the reason that asylum exists. And asylum exists because of the refugee situation during World War II, in which refugees who were in dire conditions were actually refused by countries like the United States, and people were not allowed or able to flee war and persecution. So 75 years ago today is when the first international standards were set, and the concept of asylum as international law and as an important human right came into being. So most essentially, we're celebrating the idea that when people are facing war and persecution in their home countries, that there is a sense of responsibility and obligation for other countries to receive those people and to create positive conditions for them to rebuild their lives and to be able to heal and create a home in a new country.
That really ties into current events.
It does. It does. You know, and I think, you know, what's profound right now is there are over 200 million people who are displaced from their homes in the world. You know, so it's a very real issue. It's a very real issue in Sudan right now. It's a very real issue in many countries where we're seeing refugee populations becoming extremely vulnerable. So we're educating about the human right to migrate. Human beings have always migrated. It will always be an issue. We can expect people to need to leave their regions or the areas they live in for a variety of reasons, and we need to create immigration policy that represents that people need to move and they need to be received.
when it comes to unstable situations in countries, that the U.S. has had much of the influence in those countries leading to the current situations. What did you say?
Hugely. Yeah. And, you know, my own personal background is that I worked in Guatemala in the mid-1980s, which was a time period after there had been extreme political instability and military governments in Guatemala, beginning with a coup in 1954 that the United States sponsored, bringing this series of military rulers into Guatemala. So when I was there in 1986, it was when the first civilian government of Venancio Cerezo came to power, and it was the first time that labor unions and other human rights organizations were able to come out onto the streets and begin to advocate to find their disappeared relatives and to look for justice rather than impunity for the travesty that happened. And so it's very real to me that the refugees that we're seeing from Guatemala these days are the children and grandchildren of folks who were dealing with the extreme repression that had happened in the 1980s. So the lack of stability in Guatemala, the fact that there are a lot of gangs that are operating, those gangs are the new members of what were the former death squads. So the destabilization of the military government, which was constructed by the United States, has led to continued economic concentration of wealth in the hands of a few. It has also allowed these drug lords to continue to operate and destabilize the country. So they're very, very linked to historic U.S. policy in Guatemala, but in many of these countries.
Well, you've given us a great primer on the education, which will be a part of this event, but there's also food and music. So could you talk about, beyond the education, what else will be a part of Sunday's celebration of asylum?
Yeah, I mean, we're really excited. There is a cooking collective of Venezuelans that's come together, and today they were shopping to buy the food that they are going to be cooking for the dinner. They're going to be making traditional arepas, which are a Venezuelan food many people are familiar with. So they're great because you can make them meat-based, you can make them bean-based. So we're going to have vegetarian options as well as kind of more traditional Venezuelan cuisine. We're going to have some of the local asylum seekers speaking about their journeys and how they came to be in the capital region. We have two music groups that are performing. Taina Asili will be playing to start the event. And then we have Mixed Roots, which is a local Afro-Caribbean kind of inspired band that will also be playing at the end. So, and the goal of this event is to support the local asylum seekers who are in the hotels and to, you know, gather funds to continue to support their food access while they're here.
Cool. And if someone would like to make a reservation or a donation, when should they reach out by?
So our reservation deadline is today, but we will be accepting reservations up until the event. We think we'll be able to accommodate a few more people. So if people want to make a reservation, they can call Victor at 207-590-5148. He's taking dinner reservations by either phone call or text. And people are welcome to make donations at the event, or they can contact us to learn more about that.
And we, this event, so this interview is happening on Thursday evening, will be replayed on Friday morning. If somebody wants to attend and doesn't want to eat, is that also a possibility?
That is also a possibility. Yeah, we would love to have people. And we're not going to have, you know, problems accommodating people in the space. We're really lucky to be holding this at the First Lutheran Church, which has room to accommodate, you know, at least, you know, over 200 people. So we're confident that we'll be able to, you know, have everyone come who wants to come.
Thank you, Karen Beadle. It's been such a pleasure to have you, and we're looking forward to this event, Celebrate Asylum, a fundraising dinner to support local asylum seekers at the First Lutheran Church in Albany, 181 Western Ave, Albany, New York. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a great evening.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If people don't know, Bill Fletcher is one of the most significant Black freedom fighters in this era, and his era spans the 20th century into the 21st. When I talk about you, Bill, I always mention that you were president of the Trans-Africa Forum, which was one of the most significant anti-apartheid organizations in the United States during the era of apartheid. So whenever we can get Bill Fletcher to come to our capital region, we're very happy about that. And Bill and I work together in the Ukraine Solidarity Network, which is a national organization. So we got to be reunited after having known each other for a number of years. So that was something that we really wanted to have and be able to share.
For you, Bill, I'd like you to tell us a little bit about why the Ukraine Solidarity Movement was important to you and how you think it fits in with your other work.
Ukraine work is important on multiple levels, not the least of which is that the pretext used by the Russians to invade Ukraine really mirrored those that were used by George W. Bush to invade Iraq. And that was one of the things that struck me immediately. Second was that Ukraine has a colonial heritage vis-a-vis Russia. That is, it was dominated as, in effect, a colony by Russia for centuries. And even though, ironically, the Russian state originated in what is now Ukraine, Russia came to dominate as part of the building of its empire. It came to dominate Ukraine. So in that sense, Ukraine shares much with most of the rest of the world, which has been victims of colonialism. And so that also affected me. The third thing is my great fear of the Putin regime specifically and the growth of global right-wing authoritarianism generally. And the when you look at the relationship that Putin has had with Trump, for example, and growing segments of the Republican Party, you see that much like in the pre-World War II situation in the United States, there are segments of the political right that are more than willing to not only give a pass, but to advocate in favor of right-wing authoritarian movements in Europe and in some other parts of the world. And I think that that's what we're seeing.
My next question is about the post-October 7th environment. There's so many parallels here, issues of occupation, but also the way that these have created some real splits in the American public, although it seems from a distance at least that this country comes down on the opposite side on these two conflicts.
The United States does not have a very good history of being on the right side of history, but every so often they are, like in World War II. In the lead up to World War II, there were movements that were saying to the United States government that with the advance of fascism, the United States needed to take a clear and unequivocal stand. And in when the Spanish Civil War erupted in 1936, these movements insisted that the United States should militarily support the Spanish government against the fascist uprising and a direct intervention by the Germans and Italians. That was the correct stand. So one general principle is that when there is aggression, we should be on the right side of history.
There's obviously so much here, and that's okay, because if people want to go deeper in this issue, you guys will be at the Albany Public Library at 11 a.m. on Saturday.
The Washington Avenue branch, what is referred to as the main branch.
You'll be able to go much deeper into these issues then. If I could just have one last question. You both have an incredibly rich, long history, specifically in speaking to the issues of oppressed people. So can you boil down, like, how do you determine in these type of situations who are the oppressed people? Because everybody has sort of mastered some of this language in both directions. And you know,
well, I think what's really important about the work that we've been doing on Ukraine is that we listen to the people who actually are dealing with the situation on the ground from the bottom up. And that's another way to think about political work, instead of looking at what governments are doing and from the top down, because it seems like governments tend to make big mistakes. The United States' relationship to Ukraine and to Israel and Palestine and et cetera, and Russia, all of those countries that the United States is playing on the table with, it's consistent. It's consistent because the United States is looking out for what it sees as its capitalist interests, its economic interests, its power domination interests. They see themselves lining up against Russia so that Russia does not outdistance them in the race for world hegemony. And then as far as Israel is concerned, they're siding with the people who they see as having similar interests to theirs in that region. And that includes economic interests as well. So we listen to Ukrainians, we listen to Russian dissidents, we listen to Palestinians, and we listen to Israelis who oppose the occupation. So that's what we do.
Let me add to that. See, I think this is why history is so important. And the problem is in the United States, we actively oppose history and we embrace myth. So that then leads people to start stories wherever they want to start the story, because they don't feel bound to any real understanding of history. I mean, if you want to look at the current situation in the Middle East, you don't go back 2,000 years. That's a myth. You go back to the 1800s, and you start with the development of a Zionist movement in Europe that was in direct response to the absolute hatred that European Christians have had towards Jews since the Roman Empire. And you look at the Zionist movement as a movement that was providing a particular pro-imperial solution to how they perceive anti-Semitism playing out. And that solution necessitated aligning the Zionist movement with imperial powers. So the root of this crisis does not start October 7th. And that's the problem. When you start the story midway, and this is true if you're watching a film or reading a book, you start the story in the middle, you can't figure out really what's going on. And so for much of the U.S. public, what they're exposed to in the media is October 7th, Hamas committed a war crime in launching this attack. And it's true. There was a war crime in attacking civilians, not the military side, but simply, you know, going after civilians was a war crime by international law. No question about it. Now, having said that, did that come out of nowhere? Did that just sort of pop up? No. It has to be understood in the context of Gaza being the largest open-air prison on this planet. But that has to be understood in terms of the implications from the 1967 war, which itself has to be understood from the implications of the 1948 war, which itself has to be understood from the implications of the way that the 1947 partition of Palestine was carried out without the input of Arabs. I mean, this is what I think people in the United States got to get. Arabs were not involved in dividing up of Palestine. It was carried out by Europeans. So when people wonder why the Palestinians upset, I mean, they had a chance. Well, wait a minute now. This was done on their heads. It was done over them. So why shouldn't they be furious? So you can't look at what we're seeing right now in Gaza by just going back to October 7th. It's completely misleading. But see, it's the easy way. And the U.S. media, with all due respect, likes to hit the easy button. And therein lies the problem. So to understand, go with history.
Your quote that the U.S. embraces myth and ignores history is a pull quote for sure. That's pretty powerful.
It's not that it ignores history. It opposes history.
It opposes, wow.
That's very important. That when things get in the way, as we see now in the debates around so-called critical race theory, when the facts get in the way of the myth, you get rid of the facts.
That interview was from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
That was Negative Land from 2023 from their album Speech Free. That was Tape the Pain in Place.